Okay, welcome everyone. Oh, today is good. Many people coming for the sutras, the sutra lovers. That's great. Welcome everyone. So today we're going to continue on the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, which is the Buddha's last days and the Buddha's final passing away. And we have been just been seeing just previously how the Buddha kind of gets ill. And he has to use kind of his, almost like his willpower, or the will to live, to kind of carry on. Otherwise his body is sort of falling apart and he's almost about to pass away during the rains retreat. And then he decides that he's going to try to live on. So what we have seen so far is like a very natural thing, the sort of thing that you expect when somebody is getting close to 80 years old, especially if they have had a fairly hard life. And the Buddha, of course, did have quite a hard life because he did ascetic practices for, not ascetic, he did self-torment, self-torture for 5 full years pretty much. So you can expect that the body gets a bit fragile when you get to 80 and you have kind of given it a hard time. So we've seen a very natural progression of how the Buddha gradually declining and how he is almost about to pass away, just like any person in that kind of situation. And what we come to now is almost the exact opposite. Now we come more to like the supernatural element, where the Buddha's passing away is explained in more, what I consider more supernatural terms. And this is one of those strange things about this sutta, is that there is this tension almost between the naturalistic explanation of what happens when the Buddha passes away and more like the supernatural elements. There's almost like two different explanations coexisting in the same sutta. Why is that? And this is one of the things that you see in Buddhist history, how as time goes by, especially after the Buddha has passed away, how the supernatural elements in Buddhism become more and more pronounced and more and more. You get more and more of it. You go to the commentaries, you go to the later life story of the Buddha, which is found in a place called the Jataka Nidana, which is the introduction to the Jataka stories. And in all these places, what you find is more and more supernatural elements as time passes by. And I think this is seems to be a natural process that happens in many religions, and when a very important person passes away, it is called, I think the word they use is the apotheosis, which means like the deification of someone who has been a very central figure in a particular religion or a particular spiritual system. And this is what you see also happening with the Buddha. The more time passes by, the more unbelievable the stories often become, and the more supernatural they are. But this process seems to have started very soon after the Buddha passed away. And of course the Mahaparinibbana Sutta must have been composed, must have been put together soon after Buddha was passed away, and the narrative, the story was put into place. But as soon as the Buddha passed away, this kind of new elements, supernatural elements, started to come in, almost as if people felt this was the right way of honoring the memory of the Buddha by making it more more fantastic and more amazing. It's almost as if the people or the Buddhists were not going to accept that the Buddha could have passed away in an ordinary way. Yeah, you can see why that happens. This is the Buddha. This is the spiritual leader of this most successful, probably spiritual tradition in India at the time. And he was the one who had always been there, always inspired you, always told you about this path to awakening, the end of suffering. And this very, so absolutely crucial for Buddhism, and anyone else would have paled in comparison to the Buddha. And now he's gone. Yeah, it's like this vacuum. Yeah, and of course, when you remember a person has been so central, you tend to want to glorify them. You want to make them into something special, especially because there is a hole inside of you, a sense of lack. And then you build them up, and you build them up into something that never actually existed in the first place. I have always found that the natural way of understanding the Buddha is far more powerful than the supernatural elements. Because when the Buddha is natural, it's amazing enough that he became enlightened and awakened, and he saw that, understood reality as it acts. That is really the amazing part with the Buddha. That's what we should focus on. But when we go into all these supernatural elements, we lose focus on what is important. And instead, we focus on elements that are kind of more like wow factors, almost like entertainment in a sense, but doesn't actually really get to the core of what Buddha is about. This is a very important thing, I think, and very useful to be able to distinguish between those elements that are, in my opinion, this is really my opinion about these things, but in my opinion are more historic, and those things that are probably more likely to be later additions. And it's very clear in the sutta, because you have the two elements coming together, and you wonder which one is right. Can they both? They can't really both be true. Yeah, we've just seen how the Buddha is struggling for his life, and then the next soon we'll see how he says that he can live on for an enormous amount of time afterwards. And which one of these is true? It seems like there is a conflation here, and this is one of the things that we kind of, it's nice to try to pull apart a little bit as we go through the next section here. So let us then continue on. So now we have come to section 3.1 of the Mahapanibbana Sutta. I'm not sure which number it is in the BSWA's records, number 10 or 11 or something, I can't remember now. It's a long way down the line. And this is how it goes. This is how this is in Maurice Walsh's translation here. Then the Lord, rising early, dressed, took his robe and bowl, and entered Vesali for alms. Having eaten on his return from his alms round, he said to the Venerable Ananda, "Bring a mat, Ananda. We will go to the Chapala shrine for the siesta." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and getting a mat, he followed behind. So, here we have this idea of the Buddha dressing. Yeah, right. It's strange how sometimes these translations are not 100% reliable. There's nothing in the Pali about rising early. It's just assumed by the translator that he must have risen, so he whacks that in there. But actually, it doesn't say anything about rising early in the Pali, because really what it means is that he puts on his robe so that he can go in for alms. That's really all it means. So anyway, he goes into the alms round, and he says to Venerable Ananda, "Bring a mat." This is the nisidana in Pali. You will see how we always put out little mats when we sit down, little cloths. That's the nisidana. It's exactly the same thing. It goes back to the time of the Buddha. I don't know why we put these mats down everywhere. I've always been trying to figure out, why do we put this down? There's already a seat here. Do we really need these mats? But that's kind of a tradition. We just do it automatically, blindly. We put down these mats everywhere. So when you see us doing this, it's just because we're following tradition with not really not just doing these things, which is often how things tend to be. So we will go to the Chapala shrine. These shrines, these were like holy places that people considered holy in those days. They were like would be something very simple, like a tree perhaps, or something like that. And it would be a place where people might offer something to the deities in support of their ancestors. Yeah, just like you see around so much around the Buddhist world now, it's exactly the same thing, goes back to that time. And these places would often be in the woods. They would be outside of the city, so they would be very suitable for, you know, monastics to stay there at these shrines. And there seem to have been quite a few of them at that time. So they go to this shrine. And then the Lord came to the Chapala shrine, sat down on the prepared seat. Venerable Ananda, actually, I should also mention this idea of siesta, because it's a bit strange. It's a kind of Spanish word, which is finding its place in there. And siesta usually means like resting time, I think, in Spanish. But here, the Pali word is diva vihara, which means like to basically spend the day. We're going there to spend the day. And it doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with resting. It has to do with meditation practice. Yeah, you go there, and the Buddha is often said to practice like compassion and the metta at this particular time, after the meal especially. So it is probably more likely to do with meditation than resting, or perhaps a bit of both straight after the meal. Ananda saluted the Lord, which means bow down to the Lord, sat down to one side, and the Lord said, Ananda, Vaisali is delightful. The Udena shrine is delightful. The Gautamaka shrine is delightful. The Satambaka shrine is delightful. The Bahuputta shrine is delightful. The Chapala shrine is delightful. So the Buddha is kind of rejoicing, looking at all these delightful shrines. And these would all be places where people did offerings at that time. And these shrines actually have real, some of these shrines have real meaning. The Satambaka shrine means the seven mango shrine. Bahuputta shrine means the many children or many sons shrine. So maybe if you wanted more sons, you would go there and you would make some offering perhaps. That's how it works. And these other ones seem to be just names of the shrines. And then, straight after saying this, the Buddha then goes on to how to develop the four Iddhipadas. And it's kind of interesting. Why does the Buddha say these things? What is actually happening here? He's going on about the beauty of Vaisali, the beauty of all these shrines around Vaisali. And then he makes this jump and starts talking about the Iddhipadas afterwards. Iddhipadas is, and he talks about basically something completely different. It is possible, one of the ways when you kind of evaluate these suttas, one of the ways to know if something has perhaps been added to the sutta is that you see there's certainly this kind of big changes in the narrative. It jumped from one thing to something else, without any kind of real clarity or purpose of why one thing is coming after the other. So here, why does it say this? And then suddenly starting talking about the seven four Iddhipadas. And the possibility is that this next section, which is really the supernatural section I was talking about, that had been added later on, put in the middle there. And of course then you get these abrupt changes in the sutta because it's not a natural sequence of things. So I think the possibility here is that he was talking about these shrines because, remember, earlier on he was consoling Venerable Ananda, he was consoling everyone, saying that everything is impermanent, you should be an island unto yourself, and you should use the Dhamma as an island. And now he is saying, well, look at all these beautiful things around you. And then if you take out this section, then the next section continues with how things are impermanent again. So all of these beautiful things are impermanent. They are problematic. Just as I am impermanent, be an island unto yourself. Everything that is dear and pleasing must become otherwise, must change. And there it kind of fits the context a little bit better. So this may be, it may be one of those discontinuities that perhaps shows how the suttas have had elements added to it. Maybe it's very hard to be absolutely sure about this. I'm just showing you as a hypothesis how you might go about making such a case if you really wanted to write a thesis about this or something. I wouldn't recommend writing a thesis about it, but if you really want to, you can do that. So then we come to this the more significant part here. And the Buddha says, Ananda, whoever has developed the four roads to power, practiced them frequently, made them his vehicle, made them his base, established them, become familiar with them, and properly undertaken them, could undoubtedly live for a century or the remainder of one. The Tathagata, the Buddha, has developed these powers, practiced them frequently, made them his vehicle, made them his base, established them, become familiar with them, and properly undertaken them. And he could, Ananda, undoubtedly live for a century or the remainder of one. Sounds like a hint, doesn't it? And that's actually exactly what it is, and we'll see that in a second. So the first thing about this, just very briefly, the four roads to power, Iddhipada, the word Iddhi in Pali language usually means like super normal powers, and Pada means like a step or a practice that you kind of use to get there. So this is kind of the causes that make you get to these super normal powers. So this is really four roads to power, means four roads to, or four pathways to super normal power. That's really what is meant here. So straight away you get this feeling that now we're moving into the kind of the more magical side of things. Yeah, we're talking about more supernormal powers. I'm not saying that there aren't supernormal powers, there may very well be, but this is kind of becoming prominent now. But before I go on to explain that a little bit more, I just want to go to the very bottom one there, where it says that anyone who practices this could undoubtedly live on for a century, or the remainder of one. Now, if you try to find the word for century in the Pali, there is no such word as century in the Pali. The word century is very clearly, it has a very clear meaning. We know what that is in Pali. The Pali word here is kappa, kalpa in Sanskrit. And kalpa has only one real meaning in the suttas. It means an eon. Yeah, an eon in a sense of, and it's defined very similarly to how, you know, to almost like in, according to modern astronomical ideas, it has to do with the one evolution and one devolution of the universe, in a sense, of the world. That's how it is defined. So it's a very, very long time scale, very large scales of things. Eon is this enormous thing. That's what it always means. So why does Maurice Walsh call it a century when it means an eon? And the reason he does that is because nobody really believes that it's possible to live on for an eon. Yeah? Does anyone here believe it's possible to live for an eon? I just imagine what this body would be like after an eon. Bad enough after 54 years, that's what I'm now already getting bad, yeah, getting down when you get to 80, 90. But after an eon is like a long time. And I think everyone feels really uncomfortable with the idea that the Buddha should live for an eon. It just sounds so weird. So the commentary actually states that what is meant here is not an eon. What is meant is the full human lifespan. So like 100 or 120 years. That is actually what is meant according to the commentary. And then the translators, they have finally found a reason in the commentary to kind of get away from this strange idea, so they're very happy to translate accordingly. That's what Maurice Walsh is doing here. And other people have followed suit. But actually it doesn't mean that. It actually means an eon. And this has been pointed out by some of the better translators, like Bhikkhu Bodhi has made this point. Ajahn Sujato has translated accordingly. Because really, there isn't any basis for anything apart from that. And now you can start to see why this is getting a bit supernatural. Yeah, here is the Buddha claiming it's possible to live for an eon if you practice in a certain way. And that is kind of problematic, or the remainder of an eon if something has already passed. I guess at the end of the eon, when the universe comes crashing together, you can't really sustain anything. Yeah, even as a Buddha, you have a physical body, so then you have to perhaps die, but at least for that part. So if you read the text for what it says, that's actually what it says. So what is it that enables us to live for an eon according to this text? And that is the development of these four roads to power, the four roads to supernormal powers. Now you can see why you need supernormal powers to live for an eon. It kind of makes sense. And then you have all of these adjectives here, that have practiced them frequently, made them a vehicle, made them his base, established them, etc. This just means practicing these fully, so they are fully developed. Yeah, that's really all it means. And to the point where you can kind of access these states at any particular time. So what are these four roads to spiritual power? And what they basically are, they are samadhi practice. Yeah, it is samadhi, it is the deep concentration, the jhanas and all these things. These are the things that actually lead to supernormal powers in Buddhism. And this is what you see everywhere in the suttas. Yeah, you get to the fourth jhana or one of the profound jhana states. And having got there, that is when you direct your mind to various psychic powers, including things like mind reading and flying through the air, all this kind of stuff, but also things like remembering your past lives. So samadhi is the thing that makes these things possible. So the four roads to supernormal power here are four particular ways, if you like, of attaining samadhi. Yeah, four ways of establishing this. And these four ways are, just in brief, they are using chanda, desire, chanda samadhi, virya samadhi, use the energy, chitta samadhi, using the mind, and vimamsa samadhi, which is the using investigation to gain samadhi. Maybe briefly, just to, they're not very explained in great detail in the suttas, these itipadas, but very briefly, what seems to be going on here, just to have some idea what this is. So chanda samadhi is basically using desire. Desire here obviously does not mean any kind of bad desires. It doesn't mean sensual desire or any kind of thing like that. It means desire to meditate or desire to sit down and attain samadhi. That's really what it means. And of course at the very beginning that kind of desire is required. You have to want to sit down, you have to want to do the practice, you have to want to close your mind, you have to want to watch the breath, etc. So at the beginning of samadhi practice, you need the desire to get going. That's really all this seems to mean. Of course, that desire has to be let go of as the meditation gets profounder. But initially, you need some kind of spark to get you going. Otherwise, there's no way that this is going to work out. That is chanda samadhi, the desire to take with you until a certain point, gradually becoming more and more refined until eventually you let go of the chanda, the desire altogether as you approach the jhana states. Then you have the virya samadhi, the samadhi based on virya. And here we are going to more. These are always, remember, whenever the Buddha teaches these things, they're always sequential. So chanda samadhi is the most basic one, the most kind of simple one. Then we have the virya samadhi coming afterwards. So this is already a higher state of mind. And the virya is the natural energy of the mind that arises in the mind as you are progressing on the path. So when you have natural energy in the mind, already you are on the way towards samadhi. So you use that energy in your practice to then carry you into samadhi. Using that energy just means that that energy is required anyway, so you build on that and then move towards samadhi as a consequence. And chitta samadhi, it means mind, and usually in this kind of context it means a mind that is already coming towards samadhi already. So it's almost like you use a pre-existing degree of samadhi to go deeper. You use your mind, the power of that mind, the power of samadhi, to go deeper in samadhi. And then the last one, which is the vimamsa samadhi. Vimamsa means investigation. And this is the most profound of all of these ways. And this is shows you the interrelationship in Buddhism between insight and samadhi. Always a very close relationship between these two things. Usually when we look at the path, you say that samadhi is the source that is required for insight. You need the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path that culminate in samadhi. As a consequence of that, you reach awakening or whatever. So samadhi is the necessary condition for insight to be possible. But it's also the other way around. That's what's so interesting, because if you have profound insight into the nature of reality, it means that if you turn your mind towards that, it means you let go of all the suffering, all the things you know are no good, and you turn your mind to where happiness is. Yet insight means you understand where suffering lies, you understand where the problems are, and you know where happiness is. And because you know where the suffering is, you can let go of that straight away. So all the things that most people hold on to, the body, the five senses, the pleasures of the world, if you have real insight, you can let go of that straight away. And this is why deep insight and samadhi always go together. You know what to let go of, the mind automatically lets go, because it knows that in that area all you find is suffering. So there's this mutual thing, samadhi and insight, samatha and vipassana, always go together in Buddhism. They're like leaning on each other. They kind of build up together as you go up the path. And the more profound your insight is, the better your samadhi is. So you can know your insight, and this is actually one of the nice ways of knowing how profound your insight is to see how good your stillness is. If your mind becomes really still and very peaceful, and you get some samadhi in your meditation practice, chances are you have to have some insight, because you are able to let go. The only way you are able to let go is by understanding that these things you let go of are suffering, they are problematic. That's the only way. So it always goes together. And this is one of the great things, is that, you know, if you practice vipassana practice, well, if you want to know whether that vipassana is getting results or not, see how strong your samadhi is. If your samadhi is good, then you know your vipassana is going well. The two things should always go together. If you have that samadhi, then the vipassana will also come along with it. Two things going together. In the suttas, you see this compound, sammata vipassana. Yeah? Make compound, in other words, it's one idea, two things coming together, and you develop this together, and then you're advancing on the path as a consequence. So this is really powerful. You just turn your mind to the Dhamma, to the understanding of that. You let go of everything, and the mind just automatically moves towards samadhi as a consequence. It's a very powerful way of developing samadhi. So these are the four roads to spiritual power, the four ways of developing samadhi. The samadhi becomes really powerful and strong, and you can then enter any profound state of samadhi as you wish because of that ability that you have built up. And then, says the Buddha, based on that, you can live on for the aeon. Would it have been good if the Buddha had lived on for an aeon? He would be here now. I don't know. I'm not so sure. We'd feel really sorry for the Buddha. It would be terrible to live on for the aeon. I'm sort of glad Ananda didn't ask him to live on for the aeon, because that would be dukkha big time, I think. Anyway, the whole thing is so implausible that it kind of, you know, you can kind of put it to one side. That's what I say. So. Then he says this to Venerable Ananda, and then the next thing that happens is as follows. But the Venerable Ananda failed to grasp this broad hint, this clear sign. He did not beg the Lord, "Lord, may the Blessed One stay on for an aeon. May the welfarer stay for the century, for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans." So much was his mind possessed by Mara. So, possessed by Mara? Exactly what does this mean in this context? And usually Mara in the suttas is just a kind of psychological thing. It's like a hindrance is coming up, blocking your ability to see. But sometimes Mara also seems to mean like one of the deities that kind of is called Mara, and they come down to block you. And in this case, Mara actually comes into the story here very soon afterwards. So in this case, it might mean the real Mara. Mara's kind of hanging out, waiting to make trouble for everything here. So Ananda's mind is blocked by Mara. Yeah, and then the Buddha asks him a second time, and a third time, in exactly the same way. And Venerable Ananda, still being blocked by Mara, does not get the hint. Yeah, the Buddha could stay on for the aeon. Yeah, if someone were to ask him, he could stay on for the aeon. No, he doesn't get it. So he's there. And it's the whole thing. The Buddha presumably would have known, yeah, that Ananda, he wasn't arahant yet. It's possible for Ananda to have defilements. It's possible for him perhaps to be blocked by the real Mara as well. All these things would be possible. Presumably the Buddha would be onto this. Is it likely that the Buddha would leave it to a hint, some kind of hint, and then having to be asked? The whole thing to me sounds very kind of strange. It doesn't sound like the Sambuddha, who probably is independent and who decides himself what is appropriate. He's leaving things to chance, whether he should live on for the aeon or not. Surely there is a way to decide that. It's not the right way. It isn't just to leave it by chance in this way. And especially now we see Mara coming into the story just afterwards, and then we see kind of Mara is up to his tricks. And it is almost as if, when you read the story, as if the Buddha is following the advice of Mara. Yeah, that's almost what the story is saying when we look at it later on. And that is almost the exact opposite of what Buddha has been doing his entire life. Always going against Mara, always saying no to Mara, always doing that. And now, suddenly, at his very last time, he's kind of, okay Mara, you're probably right, I should probably pass away now. Yeah, that the whole thing has a very strange kind of feeling to it. And it's almost as if the Buddhist community is desperate to find a real reason for why the Buddha passed away, and not, it wasn't just a natural a natural consequence of old age. Then the Lord said, Ananda, go now and do what seems fitting to you. In other words, if you don't get the hint, well then go. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and rising from his seat, he bowed down to the Lord, passed by on the right side, he circumambulated him, in other words, on the right side towards him, and he sat down under a tree nearby. Soon after Ananda had left, Mara, the evil one, came to the Lord, stood to one side, and said, Lord, may the blessed Lord now attain final Nibbana. May the welfare now attain final Nibbana. Now is the time for the blessed Lord final Nibbana. Because the blessed Lord has said this, evil one, I will not take final Nibbana till I have monks, disciple monks, who are accomplished, trained, skilled, learned, knowers of the Dhamma, trained in conformity with the Dhamma, correctly trained and walking the path of the Dhamma, who will pass on what they have gained from the teacher, teach it, declare it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, make it clear, till they shall be able, by means of the Dhamma, to refute false teachings that have arisen, and teach the Dhamma of wondrous effect. So here comes Mara, and he kind of, this is what he has been trying his whole life, to get the Buddha to sort of stop teaching and becoming enlightened and get him out of the way as soon as possible. And now he is trying the same, and of course being very polite and respectful, and all of that. And then he says all of these things about, he refers to something that Buddha has said before. Yeah, the Buddha has said this. And this particular passage that the Buddha is supposed to have said, there is no reference to it anywhere in the suttas or the Vinaya. It is only talked about here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and there's no trace of it anywhere else. But if you go outside of the Theravada tradition, if you go to some of the scriptures that you find in Sanskrit, this is the Sarvastivadin tradition, they have a sutta called the Chattusparisa Sutta. And this is the sutta on the four assemblies. And that actually is about the beginning of the Buddhist dispensation, the Buddhist teachings. And that actually shows how the Buddha said this particular thing at the very beginning here. Whether that actually is the case or not is hard to know. But it is found in other dispensations, which is interesting, other schools of Buddhism. So this is what the Buddha had said, yeah? The monk disciples who are accomplished, who are capable, probably trained, skilled is actually visarada, which means confident, really. It's one of those things that you are supposed to be confident, and confident in Buddhism really means that you know that what you, you know, you have insight into realities, you feel confident about your own knowledge. That's really usually what it means. You are learned, knower of the Dhamma, trained in conformity with the Dhamma, correctly trained and walking in the path of the Dhamma. And then you have learned the teacher's doctrine. Yeah, you will pass on what is gained from the teacher. It's not actually quite correct. What it says is that you have properly learned the teacher's instruction. That's what it means. And then because you have properly learned it, then you teach it on to others. Expound it, make it clear, and all of this. And you are able to refute false teachings that have arisen. That's also an interesting one, yeah, that you have the ability to compare the Dhamma to other teachings. You know what is false and what is right, and you have the ability to actually to refute those teachings. This does not mean that you kind of go around debating with other religions. I don't think that is what is meant here at all. You don't kind of seek any opportunity to have an argument with others. That's not really the point. The point is more like, if there is a question about what is the real Dhamma or not, and somebody comes to you and says, well, these are the teachings of these other people, yeah? The Christians say there is a God, creator God. Well, what do you guys say? Is there a creator God? If so, why not? If there isn't, why not? And then you are able to use the Dhamma to kind of explain why the Buddhist teaching is the way it is. And you are able to, perhaps even to a Buddhist audience at least, to show the weaknesses of the other argument, whatever that may be. And this is actually very important. You know, you look at the Buddhist world today and you see a large number of different kind of ideas in the Buddhist world, and one of the typical ideas is this idea of eternalism, the sansataditi. This is very common in the Buddhist world, and of course as far as the suttas are concerned, it really goes completely against that. The sansatavada, eternalist view, is exactly what the Buddha warned us against. Yeah, the eternalism being the idea that when you die, you carry on forever in a certain state, whatever that state may be. And the Buddha says, well, this is not the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the middle way, the dependent origination between eternalism and annihilationism. That's what the Dhamma is. So this actually matters, yeah, to be able to grasp the suttas and to be able to be efficient and capable at refuting other ideas. Really what you have to do is you have to understand the teachings of the Buddha profoundly here. You have to be able to understand how the Buddha applies his teaching to do this. You have to understand even things like dependent origination to show that how that is the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. And only then can you really get to grips with these things. So this is an important part of it. Again, it doesn't mean that we should go around arguing with everyone, but we should have the ability to make these arguments in when it is necessary, when people are really interested and it is the right time to do so. And then teach the Dhamma of wondrous effect. And the wondrous effect, this is, what is the Pali for this again? Okay, I got the Pali here, so let me just bring it out. It always sounds more impressive in Pali than in English, so we bring up the Pali here. Okay. This is the sapatiharya. Sapatiharya is like a wonder, yeah, or a marvel. So these are kind of the marvelous things that you find in Buddhism. It sometimes translated as miracle, but miracle is not really a suitable translation. It's a very kind of Christian overtones. It means as all the wondrous things, yeah. And sometimes these things like psychic powers, are called the wonders and marvels of Buddhism. But when the Buddha is confronted with what is the real marvel of Buddhism, it is not the psychic powers. It is not the ability to read someone's minds. The Buddha says he kind of dismisses that he says jiguchi. Jiguchi means like to be disgusted with. He says, I'm disgusted with those kind of psychic powers. The real psychic power, the real wonder, the real marvel in Buddhism, says the Buddha, is the wonder of teaching. Yeah, the teaching is the real wonder in Buddhism. And so this is what I think here. So this is why he has translated as one wondrous effect. These are really effective. The teaching works. If you follow according to these teachings, you will get the same results as the Buddha. And it's very interesting, this idea that the teaching is a marvel. Because most people would say flying through the air is much more marvelous than teaching. I don't know what you think. It sounds more impressive, doesn't it, to fly through the air than to teach. But the point is that if you are a good teacher, these teachings are powerful teachings, they will have an effect. Yeah, and the Buddha says specifically that when he teaches, and that gives result in other people, they are able to see the same truth. That is really the miracle. That is the wonder. That is the marvelous thing. Because they are so profound, it is not obvious that it should be possible to actually teach these things orally and other people get it in such a way that they can also do the same thing. So they're one of those very nice little quotes that you find in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta of the Buddha, is when Anyakondanya, the first disciple of the Buddha, he sees the truth and he gets right view, and then the Buddha exclaims, Kondanya understands. Kondanya understands. Yeah, it's an exclamation. Udana was like this kind of elated exclamation of happiness. He understands. It's almost as if the Buddha himself can't really believe it. Yeah, wow, he understands. The teaching has worked. It's a wonder. It's a miracle. This teaching, which is so profound, still it is possible to transfer it from teacher to student. And you get this feeling of wonder when that happened in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And then later on, the Buddha says, well, this is actually the real miracle in Buddhism, that these teachings can be passed on in this way here. And this is, I think, what is being meant in this particular passage here. So, you wait until the Bhikkhu Sangha is really well established. And then Amara continues. And now, Lord, the Blessed Lord has such monks and disciples. So, in other words, all of these things have been fulfilled. Yeah. So, may the Blessed Lord now attain final Nibbana. May the welfare now attain final Nibbana. Now is the time for the Blessed Lord's final Nibbana. And the Blessed Lord has said, I will not take final Nibbana till I have nuns, bhikkhunis. And this is one of these famous passages that are very supportive of the bhikkhunis and the nuns in Buddhism. Because what he is saying, I'll read out the whole thing just to kind of make it clear. Until I have nuns, nun disciples who are accomplished or who are capable, trained, confident, learned, masters of the Dhamma, trained in conformity with the Dhamma, correctly trained and walking in the path of the Dhamma, who have learned their own teacher's dispensation and training, who teach it, declare it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, make it clear, till they shall be able, by means of the Dhamma, to refute false teachings that have arisen and teach the Dhamma with its wonderful effect and results. So the Bhikkhuni Sangha is supposed to have a very similar, you can see here, similar kind of position as the bhikkhus. They too are supposed to be the teachers in the world. They're supposed to refute other people's doctrines. And in fact, Buddhism, he says here, is not really complete. Yeah, it's not complete until you have both the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. That's what he's saying here. So it's a very powerful testament to the idea that the Bhikkhuni Sangha really needs to be established for the Buddhism to be complete and fulfilled. And without that, something is missing here. And this is something that you find not only in this particular sutta, you find it also elsewhere in the suttas. One of the other famous places is in the Mahavacchagotta Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 73, I think. And there the Buddha says the same thing. He's talking to some wanderer, Vacchagotta obviously, because the Vacchagotta Sutta. This wanderer asks the Buddha, well, is there anyone apart from the Buddha himself who has reached awakening? And the Buddha says, yes, there are all these monks. Is there anyone else? But there's all these bhikkhunis. And each time Vacchagotta says, sadhu, it is good, because without these other people, without the bhikkhunis and bhikkhus and lay people and everyone else, the teaching would not be complete. Yeah, so it's a very similar kind of idea. The idea that the completeness of the Dhamma requires all four assemblies. And only when all four assemblies are there, is there a complete sasana, a complete Buddhist dispensation. Without that, something is missing. And each one of these parisas, each one of these assemblies or groups of people has similar capabilities, should have ideally have similar capabilities in the Dhamma, in the ability to practice and also to teach. And the bhikkhunis are a fundamental part of this. Now you may think, perhaps, I have just been saying just a second ago, that this passage may be inserted later on. So how reliable, how reliable is this? If this is inserted, can we really take this seriously? And I think we can, but for a number of reasons. Reason number one, it exists in other traditions, like the Sarvastivadins I mentioned before, as part of the sutta, something that was actually said at the beginning of the Buddha's dispensation. Secondly, as I just mentioned, the same idea, the same the same thing, basically the same idea is also mentioned in other suttas, like in the Mahavatsyagata Sutta. Yeah? And thirdly, is that even though this section may have been inserted, the point really here is that these ideas that are here obviously were ideas that were current in the Sangha at that time, otherwise they wouldn't have been included. So just after the Buddha's passing away, when the Mahapanibbana Sutta was established, this would have been the ideas in the Sangha, that the Bhikkhuni Sangha has to be strong and powerful, otherwise something is missing in Buddhism. So even if it was inserted, it's still, I think the claim and the general idea is just as strong regardless of that. So just to kind of make that point to how to read these things. So that is the Bhikkhunis. And it's important to point these passages out because there are not that many of them in the suttas, but there are enough to make a fairly strong impression here. And then the next one, which is also very interesting, the Buddha says exactly the same thing for the laymen and the laywomen. Yeah, so the laymen and laywomen also should be capable, should be trained, should be confident, learned, masters of the Dhamma, trained in conformity with the Dhamma, correctly trained and walking the path of the Dhamma, who will pass on what they have known, who have learned the teacher's dispensation. They can teach it, declare it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, make it clear, till they shall be able, by means of the Dhamma, to refute the false teachings that have arisen and teach the Dhamma of wondrous effect. So, even lay disciples, yeah, should have this, exactly the same thing. And I think, again, it shows you one of those nice things about early Buddhism. It was a fairly egalitarian community here. There wasn't this massive difference between monastics on the one hand and lay people on the other hand. It was fairly equal. And whether you were a lay person or monastic, you could teach. Whether you were a lay person or monastic, your abilities in the Dhamma would or your respect or whatever in the community would depend on your abilities in the Dhamma, not just whether you were a monastic or lay person. And I think this is an important point, because very often in the Buddhist world, we kind of create these hierarchies, and very often the monastics are kind of up there, and the monastics are always giving the teachings, the lay people are kind of always in the audience. It's kind of happening now, isn't it? So, but it doesn't have to be like that. Yeah, it doesn't have to be that kind of way. And I know in certain Buddhist countries, like Sri Lanka, is actually much more relaxed about that than many other countries. And I really, it's one of the things I really like about Sri Lanka, where a monk or a nun can actually go and listen to a lay teacher, and it's considered fairly normal if the lay teacher is really good. And I think that is a very is actually the way it should be, because what we want to do is you want to establish the teachings in the right way. Whoever has the ability, yeah, should teach those who have it. That's what kind of makes sense. This is how you uphold the teachings in the long run. Of course, very often the Sangha will have more experience. Very often they will have more training because they do it professionally all the time. Most lay people have too many other things to do it fully, but there will always be some exceptions to that rule. And it's very important that we remember those exceptions and that we allow everybody who has the ability to come forth and teach and do whatever. And it's wonderful when we have that openness, I think, a flatness to Buddhism, instead of having all these hierarchies all the time, which I think often they block people, they hinder us from being able to live these teachings fully. So please don't be afraid, yeah? So maybe during the rain retreat we should have more talks by some of the lay people there. There's some lay people here with lots of experience. that would be really nice if we could do that sometimes. It doesn't always have to be a monastic. Actually, sometimes we do have that, don't we? Maybe we should have more of that in the future. Anyway, just an idea. I'm just throwing it out there and see what happens. So that is the four assemblies, yeah, and the Mara is trying really, really hard, going on at length, yeah, talking and talking and talking, and saying, please, you know, now is the time, and may the Blessed Lord now take final Nibbana, because the Blessed Lord has said, evil one, I will not take final Nibbana till this holy life has been successfully established and flourishes, is widespread, well known, far and wide, well proclaimed among mankind everywhere. Okay. You always have to keep an eye on the. Okay, that's interesting here. Yeah, it's a difference there. Okay, yeah, so there's an alternative reading, which is Deva Manusa, which means men and gods, but here it only has mankind. So that's interesting how these things have changed. Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? Some of the different versions of the sutta have devas and humans, and this one only has humans. So that's kind of an interesting little thing here. You wonder whether just humans might be more original. Anyway, I will bring that up with one of my friends who translates, Ajahn Siddhartha, and I will tell him, look at this, and he will investigate it for us and come up with some conclusion about what's going on here. That's an interesting one. Anyway, just see these things as you pass through. So, and all this has come about. May the Blessed Lord now attain final Nibbana. May the welfare now attain final Nibbana. Now is the time for the Blessed Lord's final Nibbana. So he's pretty keen, this Maraha. And at this, the Lord said to Mara, you need not worry, evil one. The Tathagata's final passing away will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take final Nibbana. You need not worry. It's like, relax, evil one. Yeah, chill, evil one. Appasukha is the Pali. It literally means, yeah, no need to, you know, just relax. And then, and this is kind of interesting, isn't it? What it looks like here, it looks like almost like Mara's, entreaty of the Buddha to pass away is successful. It's almost as if Mara's had the final word. Yeah, the Buddha has his whole life, he has kind of rejected Mara and kind of gone the opposite direction. But the very last moment, he kind of almost gives in to Mara. That's almost what it looks like here. Otherwise, what's the whole point of this whole Mara section here? It's kind of very strange. It's completely contrary to how the Buddha normally does things. Then the Buddha says, well, we don't need to worry. 3 months from now, either Tathagata, in other words, the Buddha, will pass away. So here the Buddha is kind of setting a limit on his life. And that, I think, is kind of natural. We know that people have the ability to some extent, to choose when they will die, by being positive or being negative about existence and kind of holding on a little bit. Depending on what your mental state is, the body can carry on a little bit longer. So for me, that is, I can sort of believe that. But a lot of the other things here, I find really much more difficult to believe. But again, it is my view, and you are very welcome to hold a different view on this if you like. Yeah. Yes, please, Ananda. Yes. Yes.
Sorry, Mara came and suggested that no one can understand this Dhamma, therefore, isn't it better for you to not teach and just chill out? Then he said, I will not do that until the four assemblies are fully established.
Yeah, that's fine in the Vinaya, isn't it? When Mara comes to him in the Vinaya and he says that this is profound or whatever. Yeah. Yes, it could be related to that.
Can it be therefore he is reminding that now and that your work is finished?
It could be related to that, but I can't remember now exactly how it goes in the Vinaya. The Mara Katha is a small section on Mara visiting the Buddha, but I can't remember the exact words. But it's slightly different from this. It's not exactly parallel, but it could be related to that. But that whole Vinaya narrative is also quite late, because that Vinaya narrative is also full of kind of miraculous things, and it's kind of a long narrative about the life of the Buddha until his awakening here. But yes, you may have a point. These things may very well be linked as a kind of broader narrative structure here. I would agree with that. Okay. So the Lord at the Chapala shrine, mindfully and in full awareness, renounced the life principle. And when this occurred, there was a great earthquake, terrible, hair-raising, and accompanied by thunder. And when the Lord saw this, he uttered this verse. Grossofine, things become, the sage abjured. Calm, composed, he burst, becoming's shell. I shall try to explain to you what that means in a second, because it is far from obvious. So here the idea is that the Buddha renounces the life principle. The life principle in Pali is the Ayu Sankara, or Sanji, to renounce or to give up. And Ayu Sankara, Ayu means life, and Ayu Bhavan in Sinhala, you say Bhavan, yeah, that's the same Ayu, it's meant may you have long life. So exactly the same word. So it's the light, and sankara usually in the sutras means like will. It can also mean force, but will. So it is almost as if here he is renouncing the will to live. Yeah, if you remember back to what we saw earlier in the sutta, the Buddha says that he will apply his energy, he will apply his will to live longer. And now he's kind of saying, well, I will renounce the will, and in 3 months I will die. In other words, he has set a limit, and beyond that he will not carry on. So he renounces the will to live. The force to live is also a possible translation, because sankara is quite broad in meaning. But it's a bit more mystical when you say the force of life. When you say the will to live, it's a little bit more obvious what is meant. But it means something like that. So he renounces this. He gives up. Yeah, this is what is happening here. And he does so mindfully and in full awareness. Well, obviously, he knows what he's doing. Yeah, it's kind of almost redundant. But anyway. And then there is this great earthquake. Yeah, when this happens. And again, I don't know whether there was a real earthquake or not when this happened. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, not sure. But it is one of those things that I think remain unknown. I'm not sure exactly how that earthquake would come about just because you renounced the life principle. But anyway, that's in there. We just leave it at that. And then when the Lord saw this earthquake, this is what he said. Yeah. And gross or fine, this is tullang, atullang, sangbavang, bhavasankarang, avasaji, muni. So the muni is the sage, the Buddha referring to himself. Avasaji means to renounce. And what he is renouncing is the bhavasankara. Bhava means existence. Yeah, sankara again is like the will or the force, so the will to existence. The Buddha renounces the will to existence. Tulang, atulang, sambhavan. Sambhavan means to originate, to come into existence. And tula, atula means like they are two opposites, what is measured and what is immeasurable. Tula is to measure. So this is like the immeasurable and the immeasurable. So this can be interpreted in many ways. Yeah, this is verse. It often doesn't have any very precise meaning. That's kind of the point of verse. But one way that it is often interpreted, and this is kind of the interpretation found in the commentaries, the measurable and the immeasurable, here just refers to different types of rebirths. You can be reborn maybe in an immeasurable realm, or a realm which is measurable, more ordinary. So it sort of is a shorthand for saying renouncing existence, renouncing all kinds of rebirth. Sangbhava means like to originate. So it's a little bit different from what Maurice Walsh has translated as, I think. I think it means the relinquishment of the will to exist. And it's almost like a synonym for the previous word there, which was the life principle, yeah, the will to live. And then the second line is Ajattarato Samahito Abida Kavachang Iva Atta Sambhavang. And ajattarato, it means like happy within. Samahito, concentrated. Samahito is related to samadhi. Yeah, so he is like stilled within. And ajattarahito. And this is interesting, that he is kind of happy within. Yeah, for the Buddha, the idea of renouncing life is a happy occasion. Yeah, remember when the Buddha started out, he was often saying how it would be kind of painful to have to travel around the world and teach everyone. He would probably just like to just sit down in a cave somewhere and just kind of practice meditation or whatever. And now he's getting old and he's carrying this body around, which is uncomfortable and unpleasant. And for the Buddha to get rid of all this is a pleasure. Yeah, dying for the Buddha is a time of, oh, finally dying. And this is so interesting, because one of the kind of beautiful verses that you find in the suttas is where the Buddha says that happiness for the Aryas, for the noble one, is the suffering for the ordinary people. And the suffering what is happiness for the ordinary people is suffering for the noble ones, including the Buddha. So things tend to be upside down for the Buddha, yeah? Upside down for the noble people. And here the Buddha is saying, yay, I'm going to die, hooray, finally. Yeah, it's such a wonderful thing to grasp that, because you grasp something very profound about the Buddha's teaching once you get that. The passing away, when it's done in the right way, when you have eliminated all further existence, is actually a wonderful occasion. Now is the now finally I'm going to let go of the very last bit of suffering. And abida means to destroy or to cut. To burst, Maurice Walsh has it. What you have burst is atta sambhavang, the self-origination. In other words, again, rebirth. Kavachang eva, like a, he has here, shell, but it really means a armor, yeah? Like you wear an armor, like a knight from the Middle Ages or something like that. You're wearing armor, you have kind of burst or cut through that armor. In the same way, you have cut through self-existence for the future. That is what this is about. So very, I'm not sure what kind of armor they had in those days, but it must have been very simple probably. But in the same way, you have cut through the self. The self is like this armor, this thing that seems to protect you. We feel that our self is there to protect us, to look after us. But actually, it turns out, it is just an illusion that imprisons us. Just perhaps like armor imprisons you inside. This armory, in the same way, you are imprisoned by the sense of self. And when you're finally able to break out of that, break through this falsehood, this delusion, this thing which always keeps you trapped in samsara, going on from life to life, always having to suffer because of that delusion. Finally you break through, bang, you come out of this. And then you see reality, think, wow, this is what it's like. It's so obvious, it's so blooming obvious. How come I didn't see this before? That's what it kind of, what you know, that's how it kind of is explained. It's a very happy occasion when finally you break out of that delusion and you understand things according to reality. Yes, John Treasure.
It doesn't, as you're saying, this section doesn't seem to kind of fit, because it was only a little short time ago the Buddha was keeping himself alive, and then all of a sudden he's given up just like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to add up to me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I feel. But I've kind of been making that point, so maybe I brainwashed a little bit. But yes, but I fully agree with you. And it doesn't really seem to be even necessary to... Well, you have to give up the will to live, I suppose, to some extent, because he has used the will to live to stay alive, and now he kind of has to withdraw that. So that kind of sort of makes sense a little bit. But yeah.
It was only a short time ago. He was keeping himself alive.
Yeah.
For, obviously, to get to the destination, I guess.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he's sort of, you know, it's all finished now.
Yeah, so I think the point is now he has kind of made a decision how he's going to proceed, yeah? Before, he was kind of still uncertain. He was saying, oh, yeah, I need to talk to the monks, I need to talk to the lay people, my upataks. I can't really die yet, so I better keep myself alive. And now he has kind of given himself 3 months. Okay, 3 months, that's what I will have. And in that meantime, I will settle everything. I will make sure everyone is okay. I will make sure I have talked to the monks. And of course, part of that is to give them some final instructions on how to continue after he passes away. And this is why the things that come after this are quite interesting, because it is, we already seen this already, but now it becomes even more interesting, because the Buddha now is very conscious that he will give the final instructions on how we are supposed to live after his passing away. Yeah? So this is very interesting for us, because we are precisely in that position. So these teachings are, this is why the sutta, I think, is so interesting to us, because here the Buddha basically tells us how in our present age, ideally, we should live the Dhamma and we should live the Buddhist teachings. Yes, Nicholas, sir.
A couple of questions.
Yeah.
Just wondering about the translation of Pali for everywhere, like he proclaimed among mankind everywhere. Is that actually what he meant?
That is strange, because Ajahn Sujato has the same translation everywhere, and I'm not sure if that is correct, because I was also a bit kind of surprised by that, because it sounds like it's everywhere. All human beings have access to this teaching. Obviously, it's not the case. So the Pali says Yava, which means as far as. It means as far as humanity, as far as devas and humans. As far as, I don't think it necessarily has to be interpreted as everywhere. I think it can be interpreted as it now exists, established in humanity. I'm not sure if everywhere is really the necessary interpretation for that. So I agree with you. It does sound a little bit weird. It doesn't sound quite right.
The second question is, is Mara's aim actually to prevent beings reaching Nibbana? Is that what he's really trying to get, or not really?
Say again?
Does Mara want beings not to reach Nibbana? Is that his aim?
Yeah. And the idea...
That confuses me.
Sorry?
He's encouraging the Buddha to reach Nibbana, but he actually doesn't want beings to reach Nibbana. It's kind of confusing.
Okay. The idea is that the Buddha is the one who helps people to Nibbana. Yeah. So he wants to get the Buddha out of the way. The Buddha's going to get to Nibbana anyway. It's too late. Too late with the Buddha. So he might as well kind of... So he wants to get him out of the way. The idea is that Mara is almost like the incarnation of power abuse in samsara. He wants to have power over beings and control over beings. He lives, according to the commentaries, Mara is the ruler of the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. And Paranimitta means, Nimitta means created, and Para is others. So created by others. And Vasavati means to exert power. So he exerts power of the creations of others. So basically he is like a control freak, and a control freak the leader of control freaks. So he wants beings to hang out in samsara, so he kind of has a larger realm, I suppose. He has more people to control. So he wants to kind of get rid of the Buddha, because the Buddha takes them away. So Mara is not so much evil. He's evil in the sense that, in the sense that he stops people from getting enlightened, but not evil in the sense that he necessarily wants people to suffer very much, you know. So papa is the Pali word for translated as evil, and papa means something like bad, perhaps. Doesn't necessarily mean evil as such. So he's like the bad one, I never really liked these Christian words like evil, because it has so many undertones and so many extra.
So he'd be more concerned with beings reaching enlightenment rather than Nirvana as such, because that's the point at which you lose control of the
interest. Exactly. Yeah, I suppose that's probably the right way of putting it. Yeah.
Thank you.
But Nibbana usually means enlightenment. It's usually the same thing. Usually the word Nibbana actually means enlightenment in the suttas. When people say Nibbana, they often think about what happens after the Arahant dies, but actually in the suttas, Nibbana is always defined as the ending of greed, hatred and delusion. So it's the moment you become an Arahant. That's actually Nibbana in the sutta. Very important distinction, actually.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to ask anything? I probably will stop there, actually, because it's already getting a bit late. So please ask questions if you like. Mr. Prince.
Yes, again. Is Mara sort of trying to claim credit for the Buddha, because the Buddha's already more or less made up his mind, seeing Ananda didn't take the hint?
Yeah. So he wants to take the claim that they kind of that he helped the Buddha to become finally Nirvana. Is that what he mean, or?
No, he's claiming credit for the Buddha's actions, if you like. Just like a politician does, sort of thing, you know?
Okay. Okay. So take credit for the Buddha renouncing the life principle and staying on for 3 months? Is that what you're referring to, or?
Yes.
Yeah, kind of? Okay. Yes, maybe there is something. Possibly. So when he goes back to the Mara realm, he tells all the other Maras, yeah, I can take credit. You know, I did this, and the Buddha kind of did this because of me. Something like that. That's possible. I don't think there is any evidence for that in the suttas, but yeah, maybe. That's an interesting hypothesis, yeah. Yeah. Can There's always room for another sub-commentary, you know? The sub-commentary that you still get written, you can write a sub-commentary on that one here and see what happens. Any other questions? Please don't feel shy to ask questions. Sometimes I know what it's like. You feel that you... Thank you very much, sir. Okay. Sometimes you feel that you don't know enough to ask questions, but it's okay to ask really simple questions. And usually, if you feel the question is stupid, usually means it's a really good one. Yeah? So if you feel the question is stupid, that's definitely you should ask it if you feel the question is stupid. So don't feel shy about that. Because the whole point to come to these classes is the idea to kind of gain an understanding of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah? So the whole point. So please. Bill, have you got a stupid question?
Yeah? Well, not sure.
Not sure? Okay.
It mentions a great earthquake, and I believe there's quite a few occasions when there's a big earthquake. But how big are these earthquakes? I mean, is it like the last earthquake they had in Nepal or something like that, where, you know, thousands of people died? And
How large they are? There may be something in the commentaries or sub-commentaries or sub-sub-commentaries about the size of the actual earthquake, but I think... Actually, it comes up next in the sutta. It comes up the 8 causes of earthquakes. And one of those causes seem to be natural causes. Yeah? So it seems to be roughly the same as a natural earthquake in the present day. Yeah, some of them can be very large, some of them can be very small. So I guess it depends on the circumstance.
Yeah, but I mean, there was also an earthquake when the Buddha was born, I think, and when he became enlightened. And now when he's given up the will to live, if you like, and also again at his Parinibbana.
So you reckon all of these people were dying when the Buddha got enlightened because of massive earthquakes? Is that what you're saying?
Well, possibly, yeah. I don't know. So, that's my question.
That's an interesting point, actually. So maybe that can be the downside of enlightenment. Yeah, that's sort of what things that you have.
One.
Yeah, exactly. But I will talk about that next time around, because what is interesting about these earthquakes, it seems to have been expanded. It seems to originally have been only a couple or two or three different kinds of earthquakes. And later over time, the list was expanded. You get more and more kinds of earthquakes. Yeah, so it was kind of initially it was quite naturalistic. It wasn't kind of super, too much too supernatural, but over time it became more and more supernatural. So this is actually one of those interesting questions, but I'll touch more on that next time. But now you've actually brought up a very interesting point about whether enlightenment has these detrimental effects, so we'll discuss that as well.
Can I say something about earthquakes?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, from my understanding, this Buddhist earthquake, okay, there are two types of earthquake, you know. One is horizontal and one is vertical, you know.
Uh-huh.
In the Buddhist sense, is the one is good and one is bad, you know. One bad one kills people, you know.
Uh-huh.
So the good one, when like Buddha, you know, you think it's a good one, it's like a gun salute, you know.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, okay.
Like it's a good earthquake, like uh-huh. you like hooray, you know, the Buddha okay. said, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's what I understand. That's the book from Master Xuan Hua.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Wow. This is probably some commentary I haven't read in that case. Okay. Good earthquakes and bad earthquakes. Okay, that's interesting. So there you are. Maybe that answers your question, Bill. Good and bad earthquakes. Okay. Oh, over here, Nicholas. Yeah.
Is the Pali word really earthquake? Like, is it really translated as that? Or could it be more like there's waves of goodwill or something that it's more in that sense, like
sorry?
An earthquake sense?
The Pali word is bhumichala. Bhumi means earth. Quite literally means earth, yeah. It's exactly the same word as earth in English, or most people. It means both the earth and just earth. And chala means to shake. So the shaking of the earth literally means... Sorry? Tremor. Chala means tremor and shaking and all of this kind of thing. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's like a tremor. A tremor would be a word for earthquake in English as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
So. Okay, let's see what.
Rather than a tremor, it's
a
quake.
What does the Pali say? Yeah, it says Mahabhumichala, which means a great shaking of the earth. That's what it says there. Yeah. So is that vertical or horizontal, Eddie? I'm not sure. Anyway, uncertain. We have to read the sub-commentaries first.
Sorry, just a quick question.
Please.
I was wondering, in Mahayana Buddhism, you have Yama, which turns a wheel of life and keeps things in samsara. Would Mara be the equivalent of Yama?
Yama is usually like the guardian of the hell realms.
That's right.
Yeah. So and you also find that in the suttas as well. Kind of is a god that hangs around in the hell realms. And kind of I'm not sure what the gods are doing in the hell realms. The whole point of being a god is to be in heaven, isn't it? But he has to hang around in the hell realms. But I think a lot of that is like kind of mythology, Buddhist mythology, and probably taken from the existing Hindu or the Brahmanical mythology that existed in India at the time. I don't actually think there is a Yama in hell realm, because the whole point of being a god Yama is to kind of hang out in heaven. Yeah, it's a waste of time to be down in the hell realms. Yeah. And so I think that is more just Yama is used there as a mythological, as a principle to show how karma actually takes action after you die, and the Rama is used to kind of as a mechanism to show how this works, but actually it's not supposed to meant literally. That would be my understanding of Yama in that sense.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Because there is also a heavenly realm called the Yama Loka, which is like in Buddhism we have this idea of we can be born in different levels of heavenly realms. And that Yama, the god there, is called Suyama. Su means good. So that's good Yama. It's kind of in the heavenly realm up there. So Yama is already kind of connected to these heavenly realms in a certain sense.
Bipolar or something? Bipolar Yama?
Bipolar?
Both.
Yeah. Yes, we can speculate about that. Just next to you, there is another one here.
Justin.
Hello?
Yes.
Cool. Just checking. I thought I'd check, so I guess maybe in other religions, for example, maybe there's, if you in Christianity, if you sin or something, maybe you have to repent to kind of be forgiven or to have some grace, you know what I mean? I was curious, I guess, when it comes to Buddhism, for example, if there's a precept which, maybe you guys accidentally break it or something like this, do you have a similar process?
We don't really repent as such. We don't flog ourselves, you know. We don't do that. But we do confess offenses. And that is good to do regardless of whether you are a monk or a layperson. Because if you have done something wrong, kind of you bring it out into the open, you reduce some of the force of that thing. If you hide it and if you're embarrassed about it, it actually tends to make it worse. But if you bring it out in the open, you kind of release some of the power that has over you. And then you try to kind of make an effort, determined effort to try to avoid making the same mistake in the future. So it is important, and of course very important part as well is to ask for forgiveness. If you've done something wrong to someone, ask for forgiveness, because then you resolve any issues that might be there between people. So yes, it is very much part of Buddhism as well. We don't do confession in Buddhism, but yes, absolutely.
Thank you. And also curious as well, how many precepts is there? How many precepts is there? For example,
depends on who you are.
Okay.
Depends how many you take. Yeah, the minimum precepts is zero. But we recommend that taking more than zero. You're not really doing all that much if you take zero precepts. But usually the tradition is that you usually take five precepts. Yeah. But if you don't want to take all five, you kind of hold your hands like this. Yeah, you're saying one. If you don't want to, you kind of put two hands down. Yeah, maybe I'm taking four. Yeah, three, two precepts. So depending on how many fingers you have up. And actually, people sometimes do these kind of things, yeah, because they don't really want it. They really want to drink, yeah. So they kind of put down that one of them. Now you can drink. You can only keep the other one. So you don't really want to kind of. You want to have a lover, so you kind of take that one down, yeah. So it depends on this. But generally speaking, there's five precepts for most lay Buddhists, and they are not to kill any living beings, not to steal, not to have any bad forms of sexual relations. It really means staying with your partner, not to lie, and the last one, not to use intoxicants, drugs or alcohol intoxicants. Those are the five basic precepts. And then you expand on that. So when you become a novice monk, like a couple of monks here are novice monks, you go to 10 precepts. And then that becomes more of an act of renunciation, because part of the Buddhist path is also renouncing things. Renounce things like money, entertainment. You seek happiness within rather than without. And then when you become a monk, you take on 227 precepts, which sounds absolutely terrible. It sounds like, how come earth can we even remember them? That's what it sounds like. And actually, there are many monks who can't. But there's a story actually in the sutta, the monkey couldn't remember them. He went to Buddha, I can't remember all this precepts, what am I supposed to do? Buddha, okay, just be nice, just be kind and you'll be fine. So it is not, so you can see the basis, what the precepts are about. And actually, if you are a novice monk and you are keeping 10 precepts, you are essentially keeping the principle of all the 227 precepts already. They are just kind of expansions and details of the 10 precepts. A little bit more, but not that much more. So it may sound awful, it may sound like I never want to become a Buddhist monk because of all those precepts, but actually it is not that different from 10 precepts. And the nuns, they have 311 precepts. They have even more precepts. But again, it's a similar kind of thing. It's just an expansion on the basic ones. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Well, that's very nice. People ask lots of questions. That's good. Anyone else like to ask any questions? Yes, I'm going to do those in a second. Yeah. I'm coming to those now. Everyone is okay? Okay, so let's have a look at what is outside of the center. This is from Christoph in Poland. How and when should one study the Abhidhamma? I would like to know how the Abhidhamma fits into the path. Okay, how? That's already assuming a lot. Yeah, if you're saying how, maybe it doesn't fit in. Maybe there is no how. It is not really required. And the point about the Abhidhamma is that you don't actually have to study it. And this is, I think, one of those important things to realize, because a lot of people spend a lot of time studying the Abhidhamma, and very often they say, oh, it's just intellectual stuff. Yeah, and it actually tends to be very intellectual, and very often does not have very many practical consequences. Some people would argue that it does have practical consequences, but I must admit, I have my doubts sometimes. But the most important thing about the Abhidhamma, to know about it, is that it is not the word of the Buddha. And this goes against Buddhist traditions. So by saying that, many people will disagree with that. But to me, it is very clear that it is not part of the word of the Buddha. How do we know that? There's many, many different ways you know that. When you read the Abhidhamma, the language is completely different from the suttas. Different words are being used, different structure, the way it is put together, the way it reads is completely different, the sentence structures are different, the way the ideas are expressed are different. The actual ideas in the Abhidhamma are based on the suttas, but they are a further development. That's also very obvious when you start reading it. In other words, the suttas are primary, the Abhidhamma is based on that. So you know the suttas must have come first, and then the Abhidhamma further develops those ideas. They are a later stratum of literature, if you like, coming after the suttas. So these are some of the ways we know this. Another way we know this is that the Abhidhamma exists in many different schools. You have the Abhidhamma of the Theravada, you have Abhidhamma of Sarvastivada, you have some Abhidhamma texts of the Dhammaguptaka. These are three different ancient schools of Buddhism, and they are all different. Yeah, very significant differences. But the suttas, if you compare the suttas in these different schools, they are very, very similar. So those things that these schools have in common, that must go back to the earliest time. Those things that differ, they would have developed after the schools went their separate ways. Yeah? That kind of makes sense. Otherwise, why would it be different? So one is much later than the other one. So generally, it is agreed that the Abhidhamma arose maybe a couple of 200 to 300 to 400 years after the Buddha. It was probably over a long period of time. It probably started before that, maybe 100 years after, and kept on developing for a couple of 100 years or more. And then that's how we got the Abhidhamma. So for this reason, and for me, it has always been the suttas, the word of the Buddha, that has been most interesting here. Because the word of the Buddha, we know where it comes from. We all have to assume that the Buddha was enlightened, because if he was enlightened, everything else becomes meaningless in Buddhism. Everyone relies on the Buddha's enlightenment. Otherwise, all these other teachings are equally suspect. So the Buddha, we have to assume, was enlightened. And I think there are very good reasons for thinking so. Just by reading the suttas, by practicing his path, you get the feeling that there's something very powerful going on. But all the later Buddhism, often written by anonymous people, nobody knows who wrote the Abhidhamma. People say it's the Buddha, but actually it's not the Buddha. We just don't know where it comes from. Probably comes from people with a scholarly bent. Now, scholars can be good, scholars can be bad, but it's not given that they had the same insight as the Buddha. They will often tend to go astray. Yeah, we don't even need to ask whether the Abhidhamma is right or wrong. All we need to know is that it wasn't the word of the Buddha, and there is a good chance that some of the ideas would have gone astray because there were more scholarly inclinations than spiritual inclinations in how it was developed. So for these reasons, I wouldn't really recommend you study that, but unless you have a very special interest, unless you have lots of free time on your hands, you don't know what to do, and your meditation is already going very well. Most people don't have that, but if you do, you can do that. And maybe you find something interesting in there. There are actually some interesting things in the Abhidhamma, but you need to have incredible persistence and perseverance to be able to pull those out. And sometimes it's better to read some secondary literature rather than actually read the Abhidhamma Pitaka. It is also incredibly boring, Abhidhamma. Oh, so boring. Oh, and it's just like long lists of words and synonyms, and it's just like, oh, can't read this anymore. And there's one book, the last book of the Abhidhamma, is called the Patthana. And the Patthana is contracted, yeah, so it has all these little ellipsis points, little dot, dot, dots all the way. And there was one monk who calculated if you fill in all those dot, dot, dots in the Patthana, the book will be so long that the spine of the book, yeah, not the letters, but the actual spine of the book, would stretch from Sydney to Melbourne. Yeah, that's the spine of the book. Wow. But you can imagine that it is so long that no one can actually read the whole book in a lifetime because it's way too much. You have to kind of utter it at the pace of one page a second or something to be able to read the whole thing in a lifetime. It's completely over the top. So I'm being a bit silly now, but this gives you some idea of the Abhidhamma, because actually for most people, probably very boring, but if you are very interested in scholasticism and drawing out fine points, you may be able to find something interesting there. Anyway, let's go on to the next one here. This is from JD from Costa Rica. Costa Rica, that's really nice. Someone from Central America. Hello, JD, nice to have you here. So your question is, what's the status of the Bhikkhuni Sangha nowadays? It is my understanding at some point in history it almost disappeared. Is this correct? Okay, so now the answer to that is that the Bhikkhuni Sangha has continuously existed in certain schools of Buddhism, but not in others. So it has continuously existed in China, in Vietnam, in Korea, in the places which are now Mahayana Buddhist. But the actual ordination lineage actually comes from one of the early schools, like from the Dharmaguptakas. So in a sense, they are still bhikkhunis. Even if they practice Mahayana teachings, they are bhikkhunis in the sense that they belong to one of the early Vinaya lineages. But in Theravada Buddhism, the Buddhism of Sri Lanka, of Burma, of Thailand, and other countries, the lineage of bhikkhunis died out around year 1100 or thereabouts in Sri Lanka, in part because of famine, in part of not getting enough support. Nobody knows exactly why it died out, but it died out. And that is precisely been the problem. It died out, and because it normally takes other bhikkhunis to ordain a new bhikkhuni, it was decided that it could not be revived. Yeah, but then there are all kind of arguments why it can be revived, and I'm not going to get into that because that is a major topic on its own. Nowadays, the Bhikkhuni Sangha is getting revived again. There are thousands of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. There are Over 100 bhikkhunis now in Thailand. Yeah, the bhikkhuni sangha is thriving. It's growing very fast, getting a lot of support, being respected around the world. And there is no going back anymore. There are still some people who argue against the bhikkhuni sangha, and I find it really strange why people would do that, because there isn't any going back. It is going to be there now. It's already properly established. So now what we should do is all get on board and support the bhikkhunis rather than try to make arguments for why the ordination is invalid or whatever. It's become an anachronism. It's no longer really, it's kind of, it's gone way beyond that point. So that is would be my a recommendation to you, JD. If you have a chance to support the Bhikkhuni Sangha anywhere, please do so. That is, I think, the right approach these days. Okay, that is all for today. Any last questions? Oh, John, yeah?
The Abhidharma, I think it's in Burma that's a special holiday that celebrates the Buddha going to the Devas to teach the Abhidharma. Okay. That doesn't make sense then if the Buddha didn't write the Abhidharma.
Well, it makes sense because in Burma it is regarded as the word of the Buddha. Yeah. So in Burma, not only is it regarded as the word of the Buddha, it's regarded as the highest expression of the word of the Buddha. And this is very common in Theravada countries because this is how it's been handed down over centuries. And, you know, fair enough. That's how people look at it. You know, you can't really hear. But I think that that view is, for me, quite clearly is wrong. And this is one of the advantages of, you know, the modern day comparative study of being able to look at sources from a number of different schools. Remember, most Buddhist countries were isolated until quite recently, and because they were isolated, they didn't have a chance to do comparative studies like we do now. So it was far less obvious to them that these things were later. So they would just accept the commentarial tradition. They would accept whatever was handed down to them. It was very difficult for them to make that break. But these days, I think even in Burma, they are questioning whether the Abhidharma was the word of the Buddha. It's happening everywhere. So maybe one day that holiday will be cancelled. Yeah, we'll see. Maybe it's still there, but you know, we'll see what happens. See how it goes. Okay, everyone happy? Yeah. Okay. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.